You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment, we are speaking to researcher author Jeff Meek. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Len. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for taking time to be on Black Op Radio today. I appreciate that. Mr. Gotchenauer had passed away, and you had written about him, I think, on Kennedy's King, and there's two articles you've written. Jim had mentioned that you'd be someone good to speak to about remembering him and just talking about his contributions.
Yeah. A fellow researcher by the name of Phil Singer, I don't know if you know that name or
have
ever talked with... Okay. Well, Phil and I talk quite a bit, and I had mentioned to Phil about seeing Jim Gotchenauer on the JFK Revisited program that Jimmy did, Jimmy DiGenio, and Phil told me that he knew him. And so he connected me with Jim, and we spoke several times on the phone, twice for my newspaper column, the JFK Files. We did one in June of 23 and then another in September of 23. And I was really impressed with Jim Gotchenauer. I mean, he was specific with dates. He appeared to me, you know, we didn't meet and do this, we did it over the phone, but it seemed to me he had really good notes, and you could just hear the passion in his voice for the case and his experiences with the Church Committee and the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And it was kind of, just kind of an infectious personality. You just wanted to talk to the guy. And like I say, you know, his voice would raise and low and really get into it. And he was a very nice fellow, very good guy.
Now, what were some of the things that caught your attention that he had to offer people researching the JFK assassination?
First of all, to me, it was the relationship that developed between Jim and Secret Service agent Elmer Moore. And Jim explained how in February of 1970, in Seattle, Jim was enrolled in a fine arts program, and to complete the program, he had to teach ceramics at a high school, which he did. And while beginning his personal project, he came across the old book of 4 days on the Kennedy assassination, and he noticed the famous Mary Mormon photo, with the background, the grassy knoll, the picket fence, and all that. And he wanted to make a silk screen copy of it. So he started to hunt for a clear copy as possible. And I've got my notes here in front of me. And again, like I said, Jim, you know, was very specific with dates, which impressed me. And he said on February 23rd, 1970, he contacted the local FBI office. And they referred him to somebody that could help. And that someone turned out to be Elmer Moore. So over time and over years, they spoke many times. Moore told him some pretty amazing things, like Moore said that he was 100% certain that about who did kill Kennedy. And he said it was the Russians because Kennedy was their boy and Kennedy was a traitor. And Jim told me he thought it was really interesting that he didn't say that Oswald did it. And that's kind of what Jim expected. And Moore brought up, according to Jim, Kennedy's womanizing and how that could have been used to blackmail him. But, you know, we talked about several other aspects of that conversation. We also, in that first interview, or in one of the interviews, we talked about his appearance before the church committee. And that was in June of 1975. And before he explained to me what he experienced, he called his appearance baffling, and that he received a phone call from Bob Kelly of the committee, and then shortly after that, the guy changed his phone number. But their talk was about Elmer Moore information, and then about Carver Gayton, which we didn't go into a lot. Jim and I were planning on interviewing again sometime this year, but, you know, we ran out of time on that. So we got a call from the church committee. They said they wanted to talk to him about Agent Moore. And so he went to Washington again. He gave me a date of January 5th, 1976, and he arrived and checked in at the Capitol and went down to a basement and waited there for staffers to show up. And Paul Wallach and Dan Dwyer, he said, came to him and pulled up a chair. According to Jim, he pulled up a chair, and they said to him, "Jim, you got to help us nail this guy, Elmer Moore. He's done the most unethical things for a law enforcement officer," which was pretty striking. And then Dwyer then told him that Moore said he had never talked to Gokenauer, which Jim knew was a lie, because one of the other investigators, Pat Shea, had told him before that Moore said that, yes, I did talk to Jim Gokenauer. So that, you know, kind of set the stage for, I kind of took it as, you know, Jim thinking, you know, what's going on? He said he was stunned by that lie. And then Senator Schweiker came in and shook hands and administered the oath, and everybody sat down, and everything seemed to kind of be normal. But then there were two naval officers that came in and sat down directly behind Jim. And he said they were just completely expressionless. They didn't say anything. He used the word robots. And so he gave a deposition, which was, you know, in the background, information on Moore. And then they asked if it was true that Moore told him that Lee Oswald probably had help. And Jim said, yes, that's exactly what he told me. And then during one of the meetings that Jim Gokenauer had with Moore, he noticed a briefcase full of pictures. And Investigator Wallach asked him if Moore had a lot of photos, and he said, yes, I did. And he said, then one of the naval officers got up and whispered something to Wallach, and then Wallach said, hold on a minute. And he goes over to Schweiker, and he whispers in his ear, and Schweiker says, Jim, were you ever intimidated? And Jim said he got angry, and he snapped, and he said, this is intimidation. And he said, I looked at those naval officers, and they never blinked. And that Jim told Schweiker about the 1971 incident when a man offered to give him a ride to a theater. I don't know if you're aware of that or not.
Well, for those who aren't, go ahead.
So he told Schweiker about this incident where he was going to the theater with his wife, if I remember right. The guy offered him a ride, or said, do you need a ride? And he said, yeah, we're going over to the theater. And he said, well, you want a ride? And he said, yeah. So they got in the car, and instead of going to the theater, they went to this park. And the guy got out of the car and went and spoke to a couple people. The whole thing just seemed really odd to Jim. He felt, again, it might be a time of intimidation. And so Jim felt that Moore was really a part of the cover-up, that Moore told him that the Secret Service knew, and this was very significant, knew that Oswald had met with a known subversive the day before the assassination. And Jim said that when he said that in the deposition, Schweiker leaned forward and said, are you sure Moore didn't say 3 days before? So as Jim noted, you know, so it must have occurred because, well, Schweiker knew about it and was just kind of fishing for what day it was, you know. And the point was it the day before the assassin or 3 days or 6 days? And the important part is that Oswald met with a known subversive. And Jim just, I think, felt that because he did some checking on the Mary Farrell Foundation website and found most or all other people's testimony there. But Jim has never been able to find his own testimony. And he just felt that they didn't want what he had to say. They did not want it on the record, which maybe it's surprising, maybe it's not. But, you know, then why did you ask him to come? And maybe it was just to know what he knew, and then they weren't going to do anything about it. Now, that's my speculation. But those are the things that we talked about, and he was very passionate about it. Like I said, I was impressed with the conversations and that he had specific dates and very good information, I thought. So I put it in my column a couple of months apart, part one and part two, with the JFK files in the Hot Springs Village Voice newspaper, where I still write. And so it was a great experience getting to know Jim, talking with him about the case that he and I are both pretty passionate about. And it's a sad day that he passed away.
And it has taken just interested average citizens to look into this and try to hold the government to account. That makes people have, like myself, a conclusion the government were involved. And, you know, of course they're involved in the cover-up. So then you have to decide, well, were they in on the planning, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or just everybody saying, okay, that guy's got to go. We're only too glad. What help do you need covering it up?
Yeah. Well, as you say, Len, there's no question that there's, at the very least, a cover-up of information. I don't know if it's out of embarrassment because they should have protected Kennedy more or better. When I think along those lines, I think of the Assassination Records Review Board. And I confirmed with this, with Dr. David Montague, who is one of their senior investigators. He and I and Dr. Chester were on a panel discussion at a speaking event over in Hot Springs Village this past November. And as probably you or maybe your listeners probably know that, but for those who don't, when the Assassination Records Review Board requested the files from the Secret Service, they destroyed them. Now, you talk about a blatant example of thumb on their nose at the JFK Records Collection Act, you know, a duly enacted law. I mean, and as far as I know, nothing happened about it.
Nothing was done about that. No repercussions for actually destroying records. You know, and then you go, oh, how that Lee Oswald, sure crafty, isn't he?
Yeah, after being requested by, you know, the Assassination Records Review Board that was put together by President Clinton. I also interviewed, I don't know, maybe I'm getting off on too many rails. You get me back on track if you think so. But I interviewed Judge Thunheim, did a two-part story with him for my column. And, you know, he kind of went through the history of it all with the JFK Records Collection Act in 92, and then the committee didn't, the Assassination Records Review Board, didn't begin until 94 and then closed up shop in 98. So there's that 92 to 94 downtime there. And it didn't really hit me until he said, do you remember who was president then? And he said, George Bush, former CIA director. I thought, well, yeah, that's why nothing happened for 2 years. Because he said as soon as Clinton came on board, he started forming the review board.
So, you know, it's right through the whole political system in America. They do not want the JFK records opened up to this day, 60-plus years later kind of thing. They do not want the records released, and they just want everybody to forget about it.
Yeah, it's pretty sad. You know, you'd think, and obviously I'm not an intelligence operative or work for an intelligence agency, but you'd think after 60 years... they could view the public as, you know, a lot of people are gone from back then. They've since died. And the rest of us that are still around, you know, we come clean. You know, it seems many times that the cover-up of a crime is much worse than the crime. I mean, look at Watergate.
Well, they're not releasing the flight logs to Epstein Island, and that guy's gone. How about that whistleblower for Boeing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So...
Mm-hmm.
this is an uncomfortable fact that they don't want people looking into it. They don't recognize just how often this might happen. And in the case that President Kennedy, I think, inspired a lot of people to, like I say, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And now we're saying, what kind of country are we representing? We're bombing here, bombing there, constant war, and sending all our money. You know, there's tent cities everywhere, and then there's no end to the money going to Ukraine. Just no end to it, right?
Yeah. And then, you know, again, probably getting off the rails here, but, you know, we're sitting on how many millions of gallons of oil and we don't drill for it, and instead we fund these terrorist countries by buying their oil. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
The oil companies have lobbyists that initiate these money-making schemes. So,
yeah.
But back to the assassination and looking into it, you interviewed Gokenauer. He was another person that had something of worse. You know, even just talking about Elmer Moore, I like that thing where Elmer slams his gun down and says, "Who are you working for?"
Yes, that was also part of it, yeah.
Yeah. So there was something going on in the government, 100% on the cover-up. And then how much you want to
say.
Go ahead.
You know, I remember another thing that Jim told me when he noticed this briefcase full of photographs, that he saw, you know, some version of the backyard photos allegedly taken, those photos taken by Marina at 214 West Neely Street in the backyard. And Jim said that he could see a distinct line through the chin of Oswald in the photo that he saw apparently sticking up out of this briefcase.
Well, I've seen that photo too. And as soon as you look at it, and then you look at the actual chin, and then you can look at the chin in the booking in photo of Lee Oswald, right? And you go, well, these are two different chins. I mean, why would anyone do that? And then, you know, you go, well, they did. So, you know, like Lee says, I'm just a patsy. And then you're left studying the intelligence community and saying, well, why would they bother setting up a patsy? You know, they wanted somebody else to take the blame for their operation. And once again,
yep,
their operation is to remove a president that we thought a lot of.
Yeah, and a president who I think all indications are, as we look back through history in that time now, the president that was really looking, striving for peace with back channels to Castro, back channels to Khrushchev. He gave that famous, I think it was June 10th of 63, that American University speech known as the peace speech, where, you know, he was striving for peace for all mankind, for all people, for all the time. I think for anybody who's ever watched 7 Days in May, the movie, or read the book, it's a good depiction of what Kennedy was up against. He's chasing all these different avenues to try to make for a better world, a peaceful world, while the military-minded folks ahead above him, or that worked for him, were not at all interested in that. And I read not too long ago, within the last year, how there was, I forget if it had a particular name, but there was a plan, I think it was supposed to go into effect in September of 1963, where the thinking was, let's have an all-out nuclear strike against Russia. And while we're at it, let's include China. And, you know, Kennedy just didn't want anything to do with it. But, that was part one that really startled me. But part two was the thinking when somebody with at least a degree of sensible mind said, well, you know, we're not going to get all their missiles. They're going to fire some back at us. And the thinking was, you know, oh, 4 or 5 million Americans die, you know, we'll recover. We can get past that. And I just thought, really, 5 million dead Americans is okay. It's just collateral damage. And that's what Kennedy was dealing with back then.
I think when he's walking out of the one meeting, he said something like, and we call ourselves the human race.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
It's interesting that you got to talk to him as long as you did, and you published two articles on your, is it monthly, or how often do you publish?
It's typically once a month, no specific week. I write another column about other things too, and cover other events and things for the paper, but it's typically once a month. We've been doing it now for at least 3.5 years. I'm lucky to work for a newspaper, and my boss, Jennifer Allen, she's the owner, publisher, that allows me to do this. I don't know of another newspaper in the United States that devotes a story to the JFK assassination every month.
No, I don't. And the last one I can think about is maybe from Penn Jones Jr., right?
Yeah, you know, I think of that from time to time that, you know, this is kind of what Penn did for several years. You know, he owned that newspaper and he came out with all those 4 or 5 volumes of Forgive My Grief and different stories. And it also makes me think of No More Silence by Larry Sneed. You know, he published a book of oral histories, and that's basically what my last book, The JFK Files, Pieces of the Assassination Puzzle, that's basically what it is. It's me interviewing people and sharing the information with readers, and you can agree or disagree. I know one person criticized the book because it didn't say anything one way or the other. Well, that was the purpose. That wasn't the purpose of the book, was not to try to persuade you. Here's who I interviewed. Here's what they said. Believe it, disbelieve it, whatever. It's up to you. That's what journalism is. We forget that because that's kind of not what journalism is anymore. But in the true sense of journalism, that's what it is. Is you
yeah,
present
or,
information,
you know,
and let people make up their mind instead of being so slanted. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if some paper has an editorial, there's someone with a point of view, and they're publishing that. But like that's the way I kind of try to do. I try to let the listener make up their mind on the guest and the topic and whatever research they've done. I don't push it. So,
yeah,
you know, and then Jim DeEugenia will have all his articles and reviews and book reviews and things like that. So if you want to get further, you can go and read the actual documents and articles and that, right? But an interview as an author, you just want to hear, oh, you know, is that guy worth, should I read his articles? Is, you know, am I, you know, is agreeable enough to listen to his point of view.
Yeah. I'm really thankful for Jim. He wrote Kennedy's and King a very nice review of my book, The JFK Files. He said something like, if you don't know Jeff Meek, you should. And he talked about some of the different stories in there and how there were some things being told by some people that hadn't been said before. And so I'm really appreciative of Jim saying what he said. Is very kind.
Yeah, very good. Well, it's a shame anyone passes away. I know when I was doing my 1,000th show, over 50 people had passed away that guests I had on, you know, from Mark Lane to John Judge to you name it, right? That when I started, over 50 people have passed away and a few more. It's good that people were there this year to give a tribute to Cyril Wecht, who is getting on, and he won't last forever. And a few other people, at least they've had their research work acknowledged and contributions applauded.
Yeah, and still some of the older books, you know, back into the 60s, like Accessories After the Fact by Sylvia Meyer, you know, still a highly respected book and an enormous contribution back in the day. And, you know, what Penn wrote, his Forgive My Griefs back then, and Harold Weisberg with his Whitewash series, and Josiah Thompson with 6 Seconds in Dallas. Just a lot of really good work there. And then in the mid-70s with Gary Shaw and Larry Harris with their book Cover Up. There's been a lot of very dedicated people to working hard and for many years trying to peel back the layers and get to the truth. Unfortunately, I think the House Select Committee on Assassinations, you know, they sometimes wonder if they were a little bit worried of what they might see under one of the peels of that onion. And so there's so many things in there that, you know, they bring up, so many interesting aspects of the case that they bring up, but then they say, you know, we were unable to make a determination. Well, that's kind of where we were before the committee, you know, was put in place.
Well, especially when you add on that George Joannides was in one of the panels there. So, you know, it's the fix is in even there. And even on the AARB, You know, some of those heads, mm-hmm. of the yeah. heads thought Lee Oswald did it. His lone assassin. And, you know, Doug, good for him for you know, printing his five books, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But, to try to focus on the good research.
Yeah, and, you know, Gates and Fonzie was terrific. You know, Jeff Morley uncovering all that about Joannides, you know, that was a real eye-opener. So there's, I think sometimes people look at conspiracy hunters, those of us who chase the truth here in the JFK assassination, I think they kind of look at us as oddballs when the truth is, you know, we care about the murder of a president of the United States. I don't care if it's 70 years later. We want the truth about it, and it's being withheld.
There's a lot of people tune into this show internationally as well. So I'm Canadian. It doesn't really change anything if they blame it on, you know, on Bob McNamara, you know, or Nicholas Katzenbach or Alan Dulles. If some guy has finally said, here's the guy who ordered it, it's like, oh, okay, there's the history. There's what happened. And then the lesson could be, well, how do we keep it from happening again? You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the focus amongst the research, and this is just my opinion, I think a lot of the early research was, you know, focused on Dealey Plaza and where shooters might have been and how many shots and where the hits were and all that. And I think in the last X number of years, the focus has been more to, you know, who did it, why they do it, how they pull it off.
Well, I was sad to hear that that he passed away, and that you had just, you know, at least would make time just to, you know, talk about it and then let people know of your, I guess, respect for what he added to the research community.
Yeah, I think Jim was a real solid guy, like being a bit redundant, but you could just, he was so passionate. He would get fired up on the phone, you know, in talking about it. And he wanted to share with whoever would listen what he experienced. And I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to do those two stories and to have some conversations on the phone with him.
Just before we wrap up, is there anything that you would like to add or something bring up or a question I didn't bring up?
No, I think in terms of Jim, I think we've covered it as good as we can. One of the Jim Gokenauer stories is the last one I did before I published the JFK file. So one of them is in that book. And then the other one we did, I don't know, about three or four months later. So if there's a volume two, it'll be in there. Got some other really interesting interviews lined up. Someday there may be a JFK Files volume two. I'm speaking with James Johnston in the next few days, who wrote Murder Incorporated, the CIA under President Kennedy. You know, he was a lawyer on the Church Committee. And then I'm going to be talking with one of JFK's pallbearers. And so I'm going to keep writing the stories and sharing them with readers as long as I'm able, and as long as people are willing to talk.
Well, very good. Well, thank you so much for your effort, and thank you for just taking the time to talk about this and bring up Jim Gokenauer today, just, you know, in memorial.
Yeah.
And
Well, you're welcome.
Okay, and we'll keep in touch and email me anytime you have something you want to come on and help publicize. That's what I'm here for.
Okay, Lynn. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay, good night.
You're welcome, Lynn. Good night.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. Today, we are speaking to researcher and author Tim Smith. Hello, Mr. Smith.
Hello, Len. How are you doing?
Good. You have a book, Hidden in Plain Sight, which is on Trine Day. I think a lot of people in the research community are familiar with Trine Day. They publish a lot of books in this category of, you know, people trying to find a truth about something. And some of these publishers just aren't interested in what they might call fringe history. And other, you know, people like us, interested citizens, will go, well, this is really interesting.
Right.
And
right.
I found your work really interesting, and you've been on Black Op Radio before. And today I'd like to give you the opportunity. We're going to talk about your book and help promote it and maybe inspire people to go to Trine Day and make a purchase.
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay, so give us a brief overview of the book.
Sure. Back in the late 90s, I put together a guide when I was in graduate school. And the guide basically was this book, only very, very small version of it, probably a little over 100 pages. As this one is, I think, over 500 pages. And I let it set for the longest time. Then I thought, you know what? No one, for whatever reason, has ever written a book just on the 52 witnesses that gave public testimony before the HSCA. And I thought, you know, I would like to do that. And what I wanted to do, by the way, that was the reason it was formatted that way is, and I interviewed Blakey back in 98 when he was teaching law at Notre Dame, because I live about 45 minutes from Notre Dame. So I went down there, interviewed him, and he told me when I was interviewing him that the reason they had the 52 witnesses give public testimony, that that was his way of presenting the evidence to the American public. So I thought, okay, what I wanted to do then is take those 52 witnesses, kind of give brief overviews, lift out the salient points, kind of analyze their testimony. But I thought, you know what, if I stop, and that's all I do, then I've just created a dinosaur, because I've just taken the evidence through 1978, December to be exact. And I thought, well, that's not going to be a much of a help to anyone. So I thought I will analyze their evidence and then use it as a platform to update it as best I can through right around the year 2022, sometime in the summer or late spring. And so that's what I did. I not only analyzed their evidence, but tried to update it as best I can. And I mean, I tried to shy away from anything, went into the acoustic analysis, neutron activation analysis, photographic, whatever it was, and tried not to back away from anything and did it as best I could. As I've thought about the book a little bit since it's gotten published, there are things I probably would have done differently. And I guess you can second guess yourself into oblivion, like maybe I should have explained better in the introduction, this, that, the other. But, you know, at the end of the day, it is what it is. The reason I did it is because Walt Brown had taken the Warren Commission witnesses, all 488. All of them did not appear before the Warren Commission. Some of them were depositions in Dallas, everything. But there were 488. And he did just very, very brief synopsis of each one of those witnesses. And I thought, well, I don't need to do that because I don't have 488. I only have 52. So I can some of these I can stretch out as far as I want to. I just wanted to create a guide is what I wanted to do. And so people in the research community could pick it up and go, oh, I wonder what so-and-so said about whatever it was. And they could have the guide right before them. So that's really why I wanted to do it, was just give my contribution to the assassination literature at the end of the day.
Yeah, very good. And I think that probably a year or two ago when you were on, we were just talking about Ida Docs. It was a name for that. So you have 48, is it? Yeah, let me look. Yeah. All that you do, these different witnesses. And like John J. McCloy, Sherman Cooper, J. Lee Rankin,
right.
You know, Richard Helms, Katzenbach, all these people that if you wanted to know what they said, you know, it's all in one book. You don't have to fumble around through the unindexed Warren Commission kind of thing. But this is like from the House Select Committee.
Right. You know, in a way, Chapter 1 is the reason there's 48, even though we're 52 witnesses, they Tryon Day took, at least at one point, they took four of the witnesses, and they just put that into one chapter, though it's technically it was four chapters originally. So that's why it's 48 instead of 52. But I start right out of the gate with John Conley, and I try to, you know, I'm never really overly dogmatic. I just try to go where I think the evidence is leading, and that's how I really started with Conley. If I had one frustration, Len, it was that I'm absolutely convinced that the acoustical analysis says there were five shots. I think for my money, that's just a given. I could not figure out a scenario wherein there were five shots. And I struggled. I kind of say what I think they were, but if that scenario works, then the first shot in that scenario for me misses everything or whatever, doesn't show up anywhere, however you want to word it. And to me, that was almost unthinkable. Because to me, if any shot's going to hit, it's going to be the first one, not the next four. On the other hand, I also don't need that type of epistemological certitude wherein I have to cross every T and dot every I. I can live with some doubt. And, you know, to me, there's enough evidence overwhelming at this point that there was conspiracy. So if I can't connect every single dot, while I may be moderately frustrated, I'm okay with that. You know, and maybe someone else will come along and say, hey, Smith, guess what? You missed this. I'll go, okay, thank you. You know, and maybe update it. I don't know. But I gave it my best shot. I can tell you that. And you know, you mentioned the Ida Docs chapter. To me, that Ida Docs chapter is huge. As some of the other chapters are too. The Ida Docs chapter is, You know, this is a woman who was a professional medical illustrator. Her services were called upon by the HSCA to trace and draw the autopsy photographs, which in and of itself is a little bizarre because 3 years before that, they had the Zapruder film on national television. It's just like people didn't see it. Somehow they thought that would be insensitive to the Kennedy family. But, I mean, come on, everyone had already seen this. Now the stuff's everywhere, for goodness sakes. It may not have been then. But every time I asked Ida Dox a question, I mean every time, Len, she lied. And I don't know why she lied. I don't know if it was out of fear. There was a few times she said, you know, call Blakey. I don't want to talk to you anymore. And the first time she hung up on me, and then I had to call back 2 weeks later, and she was a little more cordial, but it was always a little tense with Ida. But I said to her at one point, you know, Ida, you know, I have the documents here where you are being told by the committee that Dr. Bodden is leading that, you know, we need to get pictures of gunshot wounds to Ida. And Ida, you can do better. And all I'm thinking, what? This is ludicrous. And so I asked Dr. Bodden in Pittsburgh, I think it was 2003, did you give Ida Dox pictures of bullet wounds to superimpose over the autopsy photographs? Without hesitation, Dr. Bodden looked me straight in my face and said, well, of course I did. I said, I guess I was waiting for him to deny it, and so I was caught a little off guard. And I said, why would you do that? Why didn't you just let the evidence speak for itself? He says, well, I wanted everyone to know exactly where the wound was. I said, well, if there's a wound there, I assume we can figure out that it was a bullet wound, for goodness sakes. But he didn't deny it. He said, yeah, we gave her photographs of bullet wounds that were not John Kennedy that she superimposed over the autopsy photographs to indicate where they said a wound was. But the fact of the matter is, when I asked Ida Dox that, she denied. Sure, they never gave me pictures. I never did that. I don't know what you're talking about. But when you look at her drawing of the back of the head of the cowlick area, then you look at the original autopsy photograph, it's obvious that those wounds are not the same thing. She is doing something with it. And some of her drawings are spot on, except when you come to things like that, then it's like it's absolutely something different. But she denied it. She denied everything I asked her. And I, to this day, I'm baffled as to why she did it. The only thing I can think of is she was scared. Otherwise, there's really no need. I said to her more than once, Ida, I'm not trying to trick you here. I'm not trying to call you on the carpet. I'm not accusing you of anything. I just, you know, just asking you. I asked her the identical questions that the HSCA asked her. Word for word, I had the script right in front of me. And everything she said to them, she then denied to me later on. So I never could figure out. Then we never talked again after that, I think it was 1998. And then she just recently passed away, at least somewhat recently. I don't know the exact date. So obviously her and I will never talk again. But it was an interesting two phone calls, I can tell you that. And I really wasn't trying to be a smart aleck, but later on I did send her a copy of, I think, one of the autopsy photographs, or maybe it was her drawing, asked her if she would sign it and send it back, and I never heard from her. She never sent anything back, probably threw it in the trash can, I would imagine. But again, I my main thing with her is, Ida, I'm not here to try to prove you wrong. This is not a debate. We're just having a conversation. But she was on edge the entire time, I can tell you. And that was certainly one of the most interesting parts of the book, I can tell you that.
It gives you the opinion that there was nothing to hide. Why would somebody be nervous all these years later?
Yeah, exactly.
Except for the implication is, yeah, maybe I shouldn't have done this.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm right, she committed forgery. You know, no two ways about it. And then lied about it before the HSCA, and then she lied about it to me. So, yeah, maybe she did have something to worry about, but I said, I don't think anybody was going to file charges against her, for goodness sakes. You know, the committee loved everything that woman said, I can tell you that. She was all in. And to me, you know, I can understand her fear. I can understand her line. And I guess I can say I can even understand Bodden's line, because we're probably talking about grant money. We're talking careers. We're talking all kinds of promotions and all kinds of things. So the people who lie, while I don't like the fact that they lied, I understand probably why they did. They were in some way scared, in some ways covering their butts. But Bodden absolutely lied. And he's still lying to this day. And the most recent documentary, what was it called? What the Parkland Doctor Saw, or something like that.
Yeah.
It's on Paramount Plus, and I sat down and watched it. At the very end, they interview Bodden. Right before that, they're interviewing these five or six doctors who say, yeah, there was this big hole in the back of his head. And Bodden, without hesitation, almost kind of in smug fashion, goes, they're wrong. Okay. They were there. You weren't, but they're wrong, and you're right. It doesn't make any sense. You know, none of that nonsense does. But you and I have known that for a long time. That's nothing new to us. But
yeah, it is kind of I'm not quite sure what the right word is. I'll say upsetting that when you know the truth and you see a guy on camera just lying like that.
Right.
Not saying, well, in my opinion or from my angle, what it looked like to me, he goes,
exactly.
Oh, these guys, they're all wrong. And I think to the filmmaker's benefit, at the end of that, they cut back to the doctors saying, well, who is this guy? He wasn't there. We were there.
that was a nice touch.
Yeah. Like, you know, putting it in perspective that, well, we were there. Like, you know.
Right.
And it's
exactly.
a shame that what we saw, and you know, like at the press conference, a doctor was told, if you ever say that again, you know, it'll be big trouble
right.
for you. And that's like an hour later. So the con is on. They're already working on a cover story.
And, I think one of the saddest parts for me, Len, when I was putting the book together, by the time I got to chapter, it was pretty early on. I think it was chapter, certainly by the time I got to chapter 18 and was doing canning, but it was way before that. It was obvious to me that the fix was in and that these people, and you know that, every trial that has any notoriety at all, they bring in scientists and one says one thing and the other says the other. Each side has one that counsels each other out. Then you go on that hamburger. I guess, I don't know. Doesn't really do much good. But it was obvious to me that they were allowing some people to get away with all kinds of shenanigans in their testimony and speak to issues like Sturtevant. He was talking about things in the Saputo film, but boy, God forbid, when Cyril Weck did that, they said, Dr. Weck, do you have expertise in photography? Well, no. Okay, then we really don't want you to talk about that. Just talk about what you have expertise in. Yet Sturtevant, a ballistics expert, he's allowed to go and say whatever he wants to about the Saputo film. So it was obvious to me that this thing was being guided very carefully. And despite what Blakey may say to me about, well, this is the way that we want to present the evidence to the American public. Well, you can say that all day long, but you don't have to read between the lines very well to see that this thing is being guided to arrive at a conclusion. Oh, sure. That at the very end, the acoustics was probably overwhelming and they go, oh, crap. Now what do we do? So they have to admit, yeah, there was a force shot. My God, this is new ground we're breaking. So we're different from the Warren Commission because they didn't say that. However, what did they finally say? You know, that fourth shot, the one from behind the grassy knoll, the picket fence, you're not going to believe it. You're right. It missed everything. They didn't hit anything with it. The easiest shot of any of them, that one misses. So I guess they felt good because they can say, well, you know, we uncovered new evidence, but it didn't do any good because at the end of the day, they said that shot missed, which I highly doubt that it did. I mean, look at frame 313. And that's part of it. I mean, you know, Salandria early on, Vince Salandria was saying, you know, people, this is a false mystery. There's nothing mysterious about this. You look at frame 313 and anybody whose IQ is in three digits is going to go, oh, wow, shot from the front, head goes to the back. I mean, that's not a deep insight, for God's sakes. But, you know, when they're done twisting it and turning it, they'll try to make it sound like something that it's not. But, you know, just use common sense, for goodness sakes. Half the answers are I think, right in front of us, hidden in plain sight. Just using common sense, you know, and then the science on top of it. And I can tell you this, science has not been a friend to the lone nut theory. That I discovered rather blatantly through the pre-together of this book, whether it's neutron activation nows, which completely shattered Vincent Gwynn, or Barger's nonsense with the acoustics. And none of that stuff is being held up through people who really have no dog in the race. The people who destroyed neutron activation analysis have no interest in the Kennedy assassination at all. They're just good scientists. They said, guess what? This guy's wrong. It doesn't hold up. And I think the same with the acoustics as well. But, you know, at the end of the day, I said something negative. I didn't mean to say anything negative about Barger. Barger is a team player. And Barger really did his best to stick with the science. And when Tink Thompson went to interview him and spent some time with him when he put together his book, Last Second in Dallas, there is some really, really good material in that book about the acoustics. And it is proven to be endorsed, proven to be true. And I'm one who I don't find the acoustic evidence as difficult as a lot of people do. And not because I think I'm terribly bright. For some reason, that just stuff just came fairly easy for me. And it just made sense. And it answers a lot of questions, without which questions do not get answered. Well, I would say if someone were to ask me, what is the thing in your book that is a game changer. It's not what I discovered. This was a fellow by the name of Keith Fitzgerald, who did a kind of a team presentation with Tate Thompson at WEC 2013. I don't know, were you there for that, Len?
2013 with Cyril Wecht?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah. At the end of Tink Thompson's presentation, Keith Fitzgerald gets up, and he had done some really extraordinary work with the Zapruder film. And when he has done that, answered questions I had had for a long, long time. And I can remember back when I first started looking at the volumes, which were not easy to get, by the way. I went down to Notre Dame. The only reason Notre Dame had them fairly early was because Blakey was teaching law there, and I assume, I didn't ask him this, but I assume he probably donated a set or whatever. But anyway, Notre Dame had a set, the only place I ever found that had a set, though Blakey would subsequently tell me that it's the most stolen set of books probably in the history of America. You can't find them anywhere. And the odd thing is, right after I left being interviewed, I went to the Notre Dame Library to take a look at them again. And they were gone. He was right. I mean, those things don't last. Apparently, people just love to rip those things off. I don't know why. But in any event, I kept reading in those volumes, the medical evidence and the photographic evidence volumes, this notion that there may have been a shot at 327 or thereabouts. And they were all ready to have Bodden come on board and talk about it. But instead, they put more time into the mob theory. And then at the end, because it was a select and not a standing committee, they ran out of money. And in December, they stopped. Had they continued, they may have given Bodden a chance to analyze that. But my feeling is nothing would have changed. Bodden would have said, well, you know, this looks like it, but the fact of the matter is there's really nothing going on here. But I think that for once, if anybody, and I give the exact time to go on YouTube with the URL to look at this stuff that Fitzgerald did at WEC 2013, to me, that explains the fragment in Conley's left thigh. It explains the wound in the distal end of the radius bone on his right wrist. It just answers all that stuff for me. And it also answers the question that the acoustics did, that 0.7 seconds after 313, boom, there's another shot. And there it is at 327. When you look at Kennedy's head wound at 327, 328, and then look at 335, you know, rather quickly after the shot, that wound has almost doubled in size. And a disappointing part of my book was you don't really see that as well as I wanted to, because for some reason, in the color section in the middle of the book, two of those three photographs are cropped and you can't see any, you can't see Kennedy at all in them, which kind of defeats the purpose of having them in my book, which, by the way, is a sidebar. Those frames weren't free of charge. I can assure you they charged me $100 per frame. And I think I had 10 frames. And so when two of those got cropped out, it was a little disappointing because it really, I think, showed what I wanted to show. I mean, it's there in black and white early on in the book, but you can't see it nearly as well as you can in the color. So to me, that answered so many questions for me that I was very pleased to see. I wasn't at WEC 2013. I saw it, ex post facto after the fact. But it was, I thought it was a stunning revelation, to be honest with you. One of the best that I've come across, to be honest with you. I only wish I could have come up with it, but I didn't.
You know, one thing I found of interest, that whenever I see John Connolly speaking, if it's from the interview in a hospital bed or after the fact, it's like he's trying to tell the truth. He's trying to say, hey, there was more shots. There were different shots. I don't know what they're saying. But
right.
I'm not quite in agreement with it. But you can tell he's treading lightly. But
yeah.
I always get the impression that he's trying to, you know, hey, can you read between the lines? There was more shots.
I agree.
And he was
totally
one of the few people that did that.
And he stuck that. He never changed one iota. The odd thing is, he thought that, Oswald did it alone, which is a bizarre conclusion to come up with. But he flat out said to his dying breath, the shot that hit Kennedy did not hit me. And that when at 327, the shot that I think goes through Kennedy's head, and the reason you don't see his head explode in 327, because it's already done in 313, and the cranial cavity, the pressure in the cranial cavity has already erupted in 313, so you're not going to see it at 327, but I think that bullet goes through him at 327, and that's the one that hits Conley in his wrist, and the fragment goes into his left femur, which was there till his dying breath as well. But you're right. Conley, until the very end, said, look, the same bullet that Kennedy did not hit me. And in both cases, the Warren Commission and the HSCA both chose not to believe Governor Connolly. And that was kind of sad. I always thought. But I agree. It's like he's hinting as much as he possibly can without getting into trouble. And then finally, you apparently probably just gave up and said, okay, nobody's listening to this. People, listen. We were hit by separate bullets.
And separate timings. No magic
exactly.
Bullets through here, through and through. And then, you know.
You know, it's one of those questions when I'm giving talks, and usually every fall I give talks to the local libraries around here, and there's a Catholic priest up in Kalamazoo who always has me come up every year on the anniversary. He always wants it on 11/22, and so I always happily accommodate him. He's just a really neat guy, and so I give a talk. And whenever the question comes up, and invariably it does during the Q&A, because I always like to have a Q&A, they'll ask me about the single bullet theory. Honestly, Lynn, I'm almost to the point I don't even like talking about it. I find it so annoying. And then I have to remind myself, okay, there are people here who probably don't know anything about the single bullet theory, so I will address it. But it's almost like this is such a ridiculous theory that, are you kidding me? Are we still talking about this nonsense? And we are. And it's like our hands are forced, you know? I don't know. Maybe Salandria was right. He warned us early on, don't go into the weeds. That's exactly what they want you to do. And every time I give a talk, I always think about that afterwards. I said, yep, Vince would be very unhappy with me. I went into the weeds once again. But I've just answered questions when people ask the best I can. And I think it's easy to get lost when you do that, but I think sometimes it is necessary. It's pretty obvious what happened that day. And you and I have known that for a long, long time. I guess I just have to keep reminding myself that everybody hasn't been into this as long as Tim and Len. And so when that does come up, address it with kindness and try to be as precise as I can. So I try to do that, though. I'm abjectly annoyed at the whole single bullet theory because it's so ridiculous. But that's the world we live in.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. It's not like, you know what could have happened? No, it's just unbelievable, right?
Yeah.
That one bullet did everything. And
right.
And the fact that they got away with it, and an official government, there's that picture of Alan Dulles, I think, handing the thing to Lyndon Johnson or whoever it was, right? You know, just like, here's the Warren Commission, and everybody go back to sleep, you know?
Exactly. And the version he hands Johnson is really thick. I don't know if you've ever noticed how thick that thing is. But I'm thinking, I've never seen a copy of the Warren. I mean, the Warren Report's 888 pages, but I've never seen a copy of it that was that thick. And so, it's kind of a minor point, obviously, but, he handed it to him with seemingly great glee, you know? So, yeah, it was fun to do. I have to admit, it was a book that was fun to do. I had a lot of it already written. And so a lot of it was additions, but there was a lot of additions. And I went back through, I tried to contact as many people as I could. I also tried to get pictures of everybody. I think at the end, Trying Day found one that I couldn't find. I think at the end, there were three pictures of people that I couldn't find. And I reached out to people who had a lot of photographic evidence in their collection. And the three still came up snake eyes. The one I was shocked I could not find a picture of was Jacqueline Hess, who had done actuary studies on the mysterious deaths. I thought, oh, for sure, I'll be able to get one of Jacqueline Hess. Nope, couldn't find a picture anywhere of Jacqueline Hess. Which is an odd little sidebar. Jacqueline Hess is fluent in Russian, and I don't have any idea what that means exactly. A lot of people aren't fluent in Russian, so I thought it was kind of odd that the person they picked for that is also fluent in Russian. I don't know if they use her. By that point, Marina could talk enough English. She did not need a translator like she did before the Warren Commission. I couldn't find three at the end. At the end of the day, you know, again, that's a minor disturbance in the force, but... it was fun to do. And initially I had a couple follow-up books to this too, that, whether I end up doing them someday or not, I don't know. But, what I wanted to do is just take certain pieces of evidence that really speak loudly to conspiracy, kind of like what Jim and, Paul Blue and, I think some, there's a couple other people in their, Chokeholds book. I was going to do something like that. Completely different topics than they use, but we'll see what the future holds. I may fiddle with something like that. I don't know, but yeah, this was a lot of fun to do, and I think it was fun because I really felt that I was hopefully providing people with a really decent guide that they could just pick up randomly and just whatever chapter caught their fancy and hopefully they would understand what that person said, and even more importantly, in a lot of cases, update the evidence as I went. So yeah, it was at no point was I bored doing it, I can tell you that.
No, that's one thing that people have an interest in, and if they want, like you said, going into the weeds, if they want to really get into this, there are people who have an interest to get to every little detail, or
sure.
At arm's length, they just say, look, I accept that Kennedy was removed, and it's an interest how the media handled it. How does the the American institutions like the FBI, Secret Service, CIA, how do they work? I mean, they just went along with it. I mean, are they complicit? And it's just an unspoken thing. Everyone said that guy's got to go.
And
they went along with it. And that could be the interest there. Just seeing how the institutions just gladly went along. Because there doesn't seem to be any opposition from anyone, really.
Right.
In power. Except for
one of the... Sure, go ahead.
I was going to say maybe the guy from Georgia, or was it Cooper? No.
Yeah. I think Cooper was from Georgia.
Yeah.
He's probably one person on the Warren Commission that was actually somewhat friendly with Kennedy. I mean, he used to dine with Kennedy and his wife in the White House periodically, so they did have somewhat of a friendship. And there's a strange connection between them, too. I'll see if I can get this right. Cooper's wife used to be married to a guy before Cooper who had been married to John Kennedy's first wife. Figure that one out. That's a bizarre connection, if there ever was one. And I think her name was Malcolm Drury, who lived a long time and lived and died in St. Petersburg, Florida, if I'm not mistaken. But I think one of the things that I've always found fascinating is these so-called attempted phone calls by Oswald to Raleigh, North Carolina. To me, this just jumps off the page, Lynn. Holy smoke. How on earth? First of all, Oswald does not have these numbers written down. And he gives the telephone operator to jail two telephone numbers that he has memorized. And come to find out, they belong to someone who is up to his neck in alligators in military intelligence. Now, what in the heck? If Lee Oswald's this kind of weird, lone nut with no connections to anyone or anything, why on earth does this guy have telephone numbers to someone deeply involved in the military intelligence world and knows them from memory? And of course, as the story goes, men in suits come in there and they tell the operator, don't dial the numbers or dial a wrong number on purpose where you know no one's going to pick up. And that's exactly what they told Oswald. Oswald, no one's picking up at this end. And then they hung up and they never tried again. Of course, he was dead within a very short amount of time. But, to me, that has to be thought about. I know that alone doesn't close the case, but, boy, it makes things awfully, awfully suspicious. You know, what on earth is he doing with these kinds of telephone? I mean, I don't have those kind of telephone numbers. You know, why does Oswald, if he's not connected? Obviously, he was. So, another dot connected.
Now, I think people will be familiar with about half of the names here, like Katzenbach and Ford.
Right.
But who are some of the people that were kind of quiet that people may not know about?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I got the table of contents in front of me. I'm kind of scanning down. I don't know. I think they probably would they be familiar with Louis Stephen Witt? I don't know if they would be familiar with the name, but of course he's the guy who is accused of holding the umbrella. Well, he's Umbrella Man, apparently, which I don't think that he is, but that's for another day. I don't know how familiar they would be with the name Louis Stephen Witt. Oh, let me think. Probably this. I guarantee most people are not going to be familiar with Eusebio Askew, who worked with what is her name? For goodness sakes, now I'm going blank. Oh. I'll get it here in just a second. You know, the gal who, they pretty much, Sylvia Duran. Yeah, he was working with Sylvia Duran, and he was at the end of his stay in the Mexico City embassy, and then he will be replaced by the guy in the very next chapter, a guy by the name of Alfredo Mirabal Diaz. People are not, familiar with those names, but that's kind of an important part of the book because it connects Oswald to that whole Mexico City thing, which, as you know, is a storm of controversy within the assassination community. You know, where you come out and what side on that you come out on kind of says a lot about how you feel what happened with Oswald in a lot of ways. And I don't know that I dogmatically say one way or another in dealing with that. But I can tell you this, that Sylvia Duran, the way they treated her was beyond criminal. I mean, she was beaten. No question about that. And Askew and Mirabal, you know, Sylvia Duran's description of Oswald is like 5'5 and blonde. Well, that's not Oswald, obviously. And so did Oswald go to Mexico City? Well, there's no pictures of him. We have a picture of someone who looks more like the middle linebacker from the Chicago Bears in Commission Exhibit 237. But there are no pictures that I'm aware of Oswald going in and out of that embassy, because guess what? The cameras were down that day. Well, that's a nice coincidence. And then when there was an audio recording, even Hoover says, that's not Oswald. So nobody says it's Oswald yet. I don't know, Len. I can name people in the assassination community. And to me, it's not a big deal. If someone says, you know, Smith, you don't believe Oswald went to Mexico City, and I generally don't, and they say, well, I do, my response will be, okay. You know, to me, that's not something I'm willing to die on the hill over. Maybe something I don't know. Because there's apparently a couple of women from Australia that did identify him on a bus on the way there. I don't know how to explain that.
So they say. And then
exactly.
You look at the signatures for the luggage, and it's all in the same handwriting. And And if you figure that, well, this is an intelligence operation, of course they got people who went along with, oh, of course I saw the guy there, and but then when you add up the times, they go, well, like you say, let's just, if somebody says that's what they think, you go, okay, fine, let's move on to something else because I disagree.
Right, exactly. And I'm not going to have a heart attack over that. However, I think one of the appendices at the end on Sylvia Odio, what's her name, who wrote Accessories After the Fact, Sylvia Marr, she makes a big deal out of Sylvia Odio in her book. And I would agree. I think Odio is possibly a key to a lot of different things. And I think the appendices in the back on Sylvia Odio, I tried to construct a timeline as best I could. And at the end of the day, it didn't work for me. I just don't think Oswald was there. However, I do think someone was impersonating. I don't think there's any question about that. That thing is a setup from the get-go. The only question is, where the heck was he during this time? And I don't know the answer to that question. But I don't need to know the answer to that question. It doesn't really matter to me. But yeah, it sounds like you don't think Oswald went to Mexico City either.
No. And then if you start to add up the number of impersonations that happened, and then you start to get into the people about doubles. There was, if that wasn't Oswald coming up the back door, it was his brother. You know, it was like, you know, this kind of thing on. And then you get into the John Armstrong, you know, thing. Well, there was, of course, there was Lee and Harvey. And, you know, I don't even know how much I subscribe to that. But the thing is, I'm very interested because he's always coming up with something, you know, some tidbit. And I'm very comfortable with the idea of somebody being an imposter, impersonating.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
The next step, I'm not so sure with, but I don't have my mind made up, so I'm happy to listen and learn. Yeah.
I would say this about Armstrong and his book, which is a massive tome, as you know, he has created enough evidence for me that it is just a fait accompli that there was someone impersonating Oswald in the United States on more than one occasion, and when they do it, they seem to be rather loud about it when they do it, but also careful that they won't get him confused with the guy who really looks like Lee Harvey Oswald, that in fact is Lee Harvey Oswald. So there's not a doubt in my mind. And I'm like you, the Harvey and Lee thing, I always get confused. Like, you know, it's like some parlor trick or a card trick at a party some night, and I'm the guy going, huh? I don't know what's going on at the time. But reading his book, which you don't do in a day and a half, as you know, and you're right. I check out Armstrong every now and then, and you're right. He's always coming up with certain things. And I think Armstrong himself has said, look, I'm just providing evidence. And if I'm wrong, then prove me wrong. And I think that's a good approach to it. He doesn't seem to be overly dogmatic about it. Just says, look, this is a problem. I mean, one record says he's in school here, another record says he's in school there at the same time. Well, you know, that can't be true. So something's wrong there, for goodness sake. So, yeah, I think Armstrong has created a storm that we will never look at Oswald the same again, even though, unlike you, I don't really understand everything, can't cross every T, dot every I, but he's created enough of a storm that I'm willing to look at that meteorological record for a long time, because that's some heck of research that guy has done.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the Umbrella Man. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but he testified that this was the very umbrella that he brought there that day, right? And then later on, somebody compared it to the Zapruder film, and it has a different number of spines in it when you open the umbrella.
Yep.
And so that was a lie right there.
Absolutely.
So then you think, okay, why did they bring a dog and pony show out and have a guy open an umbrella in there? And, you know, I think at the time they thought some kind of rifle might go off in it, like a gun, and everybody ducked and laughed and when he opened it.
Yeah.
And a little bit of humor there, but
right.
There are a few of the names that I wasn't quite familiar with, the people that you had here, Hidden in Plain Sight, which is going through all these people, their testimony. And, you know, even Blakey, you know, I'm softening on him on my old age, but I was
I have too.
I was quite upset with him and his, I mean, in one way I go, thank goodness that they brought out George Joannides, and it kind of rubbed it in his face, and they said, now do you see why we're skeptical? Right?
Right. Exactly.
Here's a guy in charge of sabotaging your whole thing and pulling the wool over your eyes, and at least you admit it, you know, like, oh, shit, you know.
Yeah.
We were suckers. We were suckers.
I remember asking him, as why did you bring Jack White to testify? And I'm not anti or pro Jack White. I don't really care. But I asked him, I said, it seems to me, Professor Blakey, that you brought him in for the sole purpose of mocking him. That's when I read the testimony, and the questions are asked, it seems like you just brought him in to mock. And I said, that seems to be a massive waste of time. And he looked at me and said, yeah, we screwed up. He never should have been called. And his big regret is not to call Bill and Gail Newman. He regretted that. He said not to the day he died. He's not dead yet, Blakey, as far as I know. But he said he regretted that for a long time afterwards. He said that was a blunder. We should not have brought in Jack White, and we should have brought in Bill and Gail Newman. And he said he really regretted that. But I think for good reason. You know, I mean, just to bring in someone just to make fun of them and mock them is just, besides being unkind, I don't care if Jack White is wrong on everything he's ever said. That's just a waste of time. I didn't say this to Blakey, but what I would like to say to him, but now it doesn't matter. I just say, you know, you're better than that. And you should have done better than that. You're right. Because that was just unnecessary, just a waste of time. And so when I went through Jack White's testimony, it was the least engaging of any chapter that I did, hands down. Not because I have anything against Jack White. I don't care one way or the other. But I just thought it was just kind of an unkind little trick to pull on him just to pad your little theory, which, you know, was totally unnecessary. You know, I mean, some of the mob people, you know, that spoke to that, whether it's Salerno or Trafficante, most people probably would not be familiar with them. And then again, I'm not sure how many people are familiar with Weiss and Ashkenazi, you know, the acoustics people that were brought in to kind of buffer James Barger. But, you know, the hidden in plain sight thing, Len, you're right. There are people in here that are less than famous compared to other people. But I would say that even the people who are famous, there were things probably in every one of their testimonies that were hidden in plain sight as well. It becomes a little more coy with those people because we know them. We're maybe too familiar. We kind of suffer from what I call the lullaby effect, where we think we're so familiar with these people that we don't go back and reread their testimony, which I think is a mistake. We should constantly reread things. But there were things in their testimony as well that just kind of jumped off the page when I went back and reread some things that I thought I knew very, very well. And I did, but not well enough, because there were things that I went, oh, how did I miss that? Or, oh, how did I miss that? Or, and I don't recall off the top of my head what those things were, but I remember at the time thinking, note to self, don't think you got this, evidence conquered anytime soon, because you really never have this evidence conquered anytime soon. There's just too much, for goodness sake. So, you know, and I think part of that in the assassination community is that we all tend to gravitate toward the things that we just find interesting. And that's probably what it should be, because you'll do a better job by doing that, I guess. I don't know. There are areas that, and I don't know if you feel this way, but there are areas that I have not looked into that I really hope that I do before I die. And one of those is probably, I think you may have even sent this to me at one time, Len, but I can't find it out. The Garrison Papers, does that sound right?
Oh, yeah, I have them. I send them to anyone who wants them. They're about 2 gigabytes, and just a drawer full. The order destroyed, and somebody saved them and copied them to PDF files, and they are enormous to go through. I haven't gone through all of them. Paul Bloch,
is there anyone...
at least, and a couple of people who were organizing them and categorizing them by the topic, by the date, and by the person involved. So you could go through and do a better search.
So that's already been done? They've been organized already?
Well, to some degree, yeah. To some degree,
some
yeah.
Some degree. Oh, wow.
I can resend that to you.
I'd appreciate that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, you mentioned Paul Blow. He's done some good work, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he seemed like a good guy. I don't know him, never met him, but he seems like a good guy.
Yeah. Well, we're just all interested, you know, civilians. You can't count on any governmental agency to actually do the proper job of an investigation, right?
I don't want the government anywhere near this case, to be perfectly honest with you. They messed up with the Warren Commission. They messed up with the HSCA. I don't want them anywhere near this. I really don't. Independent researchers are the way to go. People who just care. And we'll put, you know, a certain amount of indefatigable time into it to try to reach the truth. And those are the people that I want to listen to. The government people have not done well by us, and that's kind of embarrassing, kind of a shame. They should have, but they didn't. It's like the gig was in before they even start. For goodness sakes, I mean, come on. There's enough evidence with the HSCA. That it should have been overwhelming that there was conspiracy. And so at the end, you know, they throw us a bone. They say, well, there was a probable conspiracy, but, you know, the easy shot behind the picket fence, like I said earlier, oh, that would miss. You know, and at the end of the day, the Warren Commission kind of haphazardly and clunkily got it right. I don't need that. You're not really helping me with that type of analysis. So, the people like Malcolm Blunt, talk about an unsung hero. Goodness gracious. That guy has done stellar work, from what I understand. I have leaned on his work by going to, I think it's the UK Dealey Plaza website, where he's listed a bunch of documents that he thinks are like the juicy ones, as I understand it. And they're good. And I used a lot of that when I was putting this book together. So he's done a tremendous amount of work. Have you had him on your show, Len?
No, I haven't. I've got a thanks for jogging my memory about that too. Yeah, I should have him on.
Yeah, what a treasure trove of information that guy has. Holy smoke. So, yeah, I can remember watching. I was watching when Antonio Veciana came out and admitted certain things about who was it Angleton? Or was it Phillips? Phillips.
Yeah,
David
Phillips.
Antley Phillips. And there was a Q&A, and Malcolm Blunt, as Veciana is talking, you see him bobbing his head up and down like, yep, you know, I've looked at all these documents. He's not lying. Everything he's saying is true. It's like, wow. That was impressive. And then he asked him, I think, a couple of questions, just kind of verified it. But, and you could tell he had all this stuff stored in the computer that is his brain. And he knew that Veciana was telling the truth, apparently, just from things he was saying. That's what I call moving into the neighborhood. And he is just familiar with so much when you do that. Anybody that does that in anything that they're interested in, you just move into the neighborhood and you can become, you can have a certain amount of expertise pretty quick, actually. But he put a book together with Alan Dale, was it? Basically, it's a kind of a Q&A with Dale asking him questions. Again, another treasure trove that Blunt has given us. There's a lot of people like that, Len. They're in the community have done some really, really good work, you know, and then you have all these people on your show. And so there's one place they can go to and they just click on all these people, which is kind of cool, actually.
And what you've done in this book is collected 48 or a couple more, as you say, we're into one chapter of people and there's testimony and things they've said, which is worth, you know, revealing hidden in plain sight. That, you know, did you know what this guy said? You know what he actually said? Like we're talking about Conley, right? There's no way it's one bullet. There's no way. And, you know, now where is the book available right now?
Well, you can order it, I think, from Trine Day. You can order it from Amazon.com. You can order it, I think, from Walmart and Barnes & Noble, if I'm not mistaken. This is a funny little story. I went on eBay before my book, I think, was released on October 20th. A week or two before that, I went on eBay, and I don't even know why I did it, but I typed my book in to see if it would pop it, and lo and behold, there was my book. Like 2 weeks before Amazon released it, there it is on eBay. I have no idea. I don't know what that even means. It was just kind of funny.
That Trine Day is trying to help promote it and get, you know, pre-sales and so.
Right. That's the only thing that makes any sense. But I thought it was just kind of neat, I guess, more than anything. But yeah, you can get it on Amazon. I don't usually check this stuff. But someone said there's been 3 reviews of it on Amazon. The one review was trash, don't buy it, blah, blah, blah. And then one of my students looked on this guy's name who did that. Apparently he does that to a lot of books. Yeah, but you and I know that's not a review. You know, we just go on someplace and say, okay, this really stinks. See you later. That's not a review. That's just a knee-jerk reaction. But there was another guy who...
Or he's on the job.
Yeah, exactly. Martin Shackelford reviewed it on Amazon and gave it really high praise. And he has a chapter in the book, by the way. What Shackelford did is he went through the book basically with a yellow legal pad and wrote down all kinds of notes. And then he emailed me all the notes that he put together for the book, which actually was quite helpful. And, you know, we didn't always agree on everything, but he did it in the spirit of collegiality. And I appreciated it. That doesn't bother me at all. So his was a legitimate review, as was Jim. Jim's was a legitimate review on his website, which I'm very thankful for that as well. And so, yeah, it's been who knows where we'll go from here. You know, people like you and I just keep the torch lit. We go forward like a bunch of other people. We keep fighting the fight no matter what. I guess that's what we do.
Okay, well, I'll make links to this so people can purchase it. And maybe to the Trine Day site to help. If you buy it from Trine Day, maybe they get a little better, or they don't get a commission knocked off from Amazon. But I just want to make sure I covered it and help promote.
Sure. Yeah, if you can send me the Garrison link, I'd be really appreciated. That's something I've always wanted to look into.
Oh, you don't have any of the files?
No, I have nothing.
Oh, I'll send you the whole file. Yeah, I'll send it to you then right now. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, very good. And with the organization that a couple other people, the name escapes me, who've done. But I think we've given it an overview. The people, Baden, Humes, Wecht, Petty, Sturtevant, Gunn, right. Hartman, Barger, Grodin, Connolly, Rowley, yeah. Kelly, Diaz, Lopez, McCloy, Katzenbach, Helms. It's just everybody's things that are worth reading, and they're all organized in one place. Before we wrap up, is there anything I didn't really get to that you would like to wind up about the book?
No, not really. I would say the 4 appendices in the back at the very end, I think, are worth reading. They weren't just thrown in there just randomly. I mean, I tried to really think about it before I did. I think there's some serious information there as long as the other ones as well. But, no, I think you asked some good questions and we had a good talk, and I really appreciate you having me on your show, Len.
Okay. Very good. Well, Tim, good luck with the book and,
sure.
Just keep me in touch. If anything's new, email me and
I will.
Okay, very good. All right, thanks so much for sharing time with me today.
Thanks for having me, Len.
You're very welcome. Okay,
bye-bye.
Good night.